You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivasa Prakash.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today I've got my friend Adam Rotman from Segra Capital. And we're here today to discuss uranium, nuclear energy, et cetera. Adam, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's awesome to have you on.
It's my pleasure.
Awesome. So Adam, let's kick it off by talking a little bit about sort of your background, you know, how you got into, I guess, the finance world, and what's, you know, what's more interesting, you know, how you sort of found yourself in this nuclear or uranium focused niche.
Yeah. I was just an undergrad, like everybody else, that kind of thought they had an idea of what Wall Street was all about and that would be fun. And this was kind of the 2006, 2007 period when I was interviewing for summer analyst jobs. And it was kind of like the LBO boom, and young investment bankers were making way too much money. And all that looked, you know, really interesting to me. So kind of made my way. I was lucky to get an internship at a Wall Street bank, and I didn't last very long. It was not my cup of tea exactly. Met some great people there, but wanted to be on the investment management side of things. And then was lucky enough to go to work for a hedge fund called Corriente, Corriente Advisors out of Texas, run by Mark Hart. And that's kind of the rest is history. It's been the buy side since then. Corriente into founding Segra Capital. Segra was always focused, has always been focused on trying to find, largely contrarian or underfollowed ideas that are kind of catalyzed by macro events or macro assumptions. Yeah, so it's kind of like value catalyzed by macro. We were a small firm, I guess we still are, a relatively small firm, trying to figure out how we were going to make it in a world where most hedge funds fail. We thought that focusing on one or a handful of things in succession, hopefully, was a way to be a differentiator. So we do take big swings really on ideas that we think are singularly, or in some cases, a handful of things, like the best thing that exists in the market. And our investors can kind of size with us appropriately, but we're a best ideas fund. And currently, not just currently, but for the last 3 or 4 years, we felt the best idea in markets, at least markets that we look at, has been, the underappreciation of nuclear power. A lot of that has been expressed through trades in the fuel cycle, the nuclear fuel cycle. But, maybe what a lot of listeners do or don't know is that we do a lot of things other than just that, that are related to nuclear and other energy. So in a nutshell, I think that's it. And pardon everybody, my voice is like a little messed up. I'm coming off of a nasty bug. So apologies.
No. No worries. And this is awesome. And so Corriente became Segra Capital. Is that what you said?
No, sorry. Corriente is still run by Mark Hart. But I worked there, and actually Mark was kind enough to seed Segra Capital when I launched in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And since 2013, you've sort of been following the nuclear or the uranium sort of world.
Actually, it goes back a little further than that. So actually, when I went to go to work for Corriente, they had a rather large commodity book, commodity equities, some credit. And in 2007, 2008, actually some fuel cycle names, both enrichment and uranium mining, were in the book. And that kind of fell into, we were all generalists there, but that kind of fell into my bucket of things to watch. And so we were long in that period, exited well in advance of Fukushima, not obviously by any direct design other than valuation, really. And then Segra started looking at it again 2014, 2015, probably sometime then, you know, maybe we were talking a little bit about it. We didn't have a lot of capital put to work. We were very early investors in NextGen, maybe mm-hmm. not the earliest, but we did one of their first financings, which was our only uranium position. I mean, I guess that was probably 2014 or 2015, whenever that was. But we were watching from afar, really starting to dig deep like we like to do. And I guess, what was it? We were convinced that this was going to be big in 2018. So probably 3 years of work later, mm-hmm. we said this was something to sink our teeth into.
Got it. Awesome. And you know, I think, you know, to kick it off, so one thing that I guess all our listeners should, all our listeners are probably aware of is sort of the overall case for owning uranium or for owning yeah. nuclear stocks. And so, you know, it's mainly negative CapEx over sort of the last decade-ish and yeah. sort of the large application sort of uranium within the transition to a green energy world. And one thing that we observed about 17 years ago, back in 2006, was we had a proper uranium bull cycle. And, you know, this sort of cycle, you know, we could say is probably started in the mid to late-ish 2010s. And so, you know, since it sort of started, you know, what has changed since the cycle started? What has changed sort of over, say, the last 12 to 24 months? And, you know, when you compare this to what happened in 2006, you know, well, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, this cycle sort of compared to that one and, yeah. you know, differences, similarities, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the answer is actually quite complicated, because your question is almost like, how do you summarize the way that the buying and selling of the nuclear fuel cycle works? Mm-hmm. But I think if you were just in simple terms, like what's changed over the last 12 to 18 months is that the market has shifted. This market is kind of hyper-cyclical. Long-term contracts, relatively heavy inventories are always run, given that these are now 60 or 100 year long assets, can't run out of fuel. Mm-hmm. A lot of novices don't quite understand how to contextualize inventories, how to contextualize contract coverage. But the only thing that you need to know is that utilities very smartly have a lot of flexibility on those levers, mm-hmm. because it's so important that they don't ever run out of material. So I only bring up that backdrop because a lot of investors now have looked at this delayed capital cycle point that you bring up and haven't quite been able to reconcile, well, there's delayed CapEx, there are deficits looming in the future, and why that doesn't translate into immediate price action in the market. And I think the gap between those things is probably the most important to figure out if you're investing in the space, or the most important to get comfortable with if you're investing in the space, because there are no opportunistic buyers. Like, there's no financial buyer, really. I guess you have Sprott right. now, some hedge funds, but historically, and certainly relative to other commodities, there's very little speculation. There's still a lot of opacity. Mm-hmm. And all of that is to say that over the last 12 to 18 months, the spot market, which, make no mistake, is generally a surplus disposal. It's when there's extra material, it gets shown into that market versus into contracts. As that surplus started getting eaten away, we had more price discovery in the spot market. Like, that's if we're talking about the actual like spot market dynamics. Probably more importantly is starting last year, you started to see contracting pick up in a material way from Western buyers, Western utilities, essentially, making it kind of one of the more important contracting years in several years, which over the life cycle of the cycle is what we really should all be looking at to incentivize new production and everything yep. else. So that's like what we're actually talking about the commodity. Those two points, I would say, you know, are the big changes over the last 12 to 18 months. But then, like, fundamentally, if we're talking like industry-wide, you know, what's happened in the last 18 months for nuclear is kind of what we were hoping for, like, in our wildest dreams. As people who, my partner Arthur says this the best, you know, are climate change believers, solution skeptics. That was the heart of our thesis, which is that, you know, the rhetoric around, I wouldn't call it climate change, but around how are the trajectory of energy policy globally. We thought the solutions that were wildly held to be consensus for fixing those problems were wrong and couldn't be achieved, and specifically couldn't be achieved without a refocus on nuclear. And over the last 12 to 18 months, you are seeing that in real time, both through the license extensions in the West, new build programs that have been announced, and then obviously now in the background, what we believe is a real commitment to bringing advanced nuclear as an option into the market over the next half decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And so I think one thing that we should go on and start discussing from here is sort of the market for uranium itself. And so one thing that's important to highlight is, so when we think of the spot market for uranium, so uranium's typically the spot market implies immediate delivery, delivery the sort of today, but in the uranium world, it's sort of 1 year out from now. And so when we think of the spot market supply, so how do you think about who's supplying in the market in terms of producers and what how many pounds are producers actually selling into the spot market each month at the moment? And if you want to go into the details of how the spot market works, feel free. So
I think we'll almost answer the way the spot market works by answering your question of like who's in there. I'm not going to name them by name, but the important thing is that the uranium spot market has let's call it dedicated sellers, for lack of a better way of putting it. There are sources of supply, both producers that are in certain jurisdictions, but also mines that have uranium as byproduct, who use the spot market, or essentially like a spot linked market, to sell their material. And when we say like surplus disposal, well, that's kind of what we mean, or what I mean by that. I say some other people, even Grant from Camco, might even be have coined that at some point. But essentially, like material that's not making its way into contracts finds its way into the spot market. And there is material month in and month out, certainly for every quarter, that will need to find a bid in the market. And especially in the pre-Sprott days, when there was obviously very, very little speculation. Market was lower. There were there weren't really hedge funds or other market participants in the physical market. You didn't have Sprott. Prices really were who was showing up on the bid on any given day when there was material. There are traders and intermediaries in the market, but if you had a large, offtake that was then being sold in the spot market, if it was bigger than traders' risk, or if there was no trader there bidding it at all, you could see some pretty wild moves. And I would even go so far as to say that because there's through the down cycle, there was always a consistent stream of supply that would come into the market without a natural buyer, given that utilities were sidelined, not believing in the contract cycle yet, still drawing inventories, et cetera. Like, the market was always going to go down. It was a market that, all things equal, was going to trend down over any given period. And that psychological reinforcement, honestly, is a lot of what has set up the bull run, goes without saying. It disincentivized CapEx, lower prices, almost beget lower prices. The uranium cycle, not just now, but throughout history, has kind of been one in which prices drop, utilities let their contract coverage drop.
Right.
They also draw on their inventories at the same time, because a low market is indicative of one where material is easily available. So we might as well not be in the market. And then all of those factors change, right? And cause rather, kind of violent, upside. And some people, I'm always a little surprised. I guess it depends on when you've like entered the trade. But there seems to be like a lot of grumpy nuclear uranium investors around the last year. And like, without a doubt, the broad macro of 2022 was difficult. But like, let's be clear, like from the bottom of the cycle, where I think a lot of people, should have been doing work on this, the uranium price was like $18. It's over $50 today, and contract prices are obviously much, much higher than that, with a lot of volume when they weren't. The contract prices were virtually flat to spot and was very thin before. Like, the right things are happening here. And the other point outside of $18 to $51, which doesn't matter, is that there are these periods where you do have extreme volatility, you know, where you do see prices gap. And I've said this on, you know, I was telling you, you know, Sri, and for everybody listening, like, I am pretty selective about these things, especially since we're talking about one topic. People are probably getting pretty sick of me saying the same thing. But like I have said before, and it's important that, you know, the uranium market in particular, like, is one of layers. You know, there are levels where supply come into the market.
Yeah.
We have to chew through those layers. Sometimes we do it quickly. Sometimes it takes longer. And then there are gaps. And I think that's what's going to happen again, you know, in the future. I mean, we are setting a new base here. There's there's a lot of demand in the mid to high 40s. I don't think there's a lot of supply until the mid to high 50s. And then again and again. And we reset new levels in this market. I think there are a lot of people that invest here that think, like, they certainly thought, I guess in like November of 21, that we were about to see like $200 uranium like within a month.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's impossible. It was probably impossible in November. We actually, you know, wrote a blog post on this. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's very likely, and it's actually probably bad for the market. So what I think we should all be looking for is kind of stair steps, chewing through different levels of supply that comes into the market, continuing to focus on real end user demand, circling kind of the hoop, which they have been over the last 12 months. And then really, you know, I said this recently, like, we should be disappointed. We as investors in the space should be disappointed when replacement rate purchases, I won't even say contracted, but between the spot market and the contract market for delivery equals demand, but you're replacing it. If we're testing the bounds of that amount of demand and prices aren't moving, then the thesis is busted. Yeah. But everybody who's out there who's built a supply demand model for replacement rate contracting and saying, if the, you know, 450 and growing reactors globally need 190-ish million pounds, if you're buying 190 million pounds in a given year and the price isn't moving, that's a problem for the thesis. If we're buying 80 million to 120 million in a market that can supply that and we're still going up, that's also a good thing. And that's kind of what's been happening, right? Like, the market has been balanced in terms of what's being purchased and sold. And actually, we're still rising in that environment. So sorry, I kind of rambled there, but that's just addressing this idea that this is like a waiting for Godot situation. Like, it's not. Everything is happening the way it should be, and setting up very, very well for the coming years.
I think one, you're 100% right on that. And, you know, one of the things that you've sort of discussed in one of your previous commentaries that you've published on the Secura Capital website is, you know, that is sort of, you know, what you call the spot supply that no one talks about. And so, you know, while people are aware of this idea that, you know, there are these various prices or these various levels at which, you know, different suppliers come in and different producers come in, you know, and supply uranium to the market, you know, there's a few things like trust units for physical, you know, block trades, as well as, you know, utility contract structures and, you know, various flex options within those contract structures that that affect supply. And then three, what I found really interesting was, you know, what you call carry trades within the uranium market. So, you know, could you jump in and talk a little bit about what these are and, you know, how much these matter?
Yeah, well, one, the biggest point, I think, from what you bring up is that, and this is, I think, what we do differently, like at Segura, if I'm being just frank, is that this is a very complex market. Like, this is not as simple as what is spot doing on any given day, and then should we buy or sell equities?
Like, exactly. And I think this is super under-discussed, so I think this is something that's worth bringing up.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, like, in asking the question. Like, one, spot is the lesser of the two prices. Like, sure, I mean, if the market chooses to focus on that, we have to be conscious of it. But let's, you know, be clear that, like, through a cycle, you know, contracting is what's driving business models and supply decisions, ramp or up or ramp down, et cetera. The fuel cycle, the components talk to each other. You know, what's happening in the spot market cannot be looked at in isolation, or I should say U308 prices cannot be looked at in isolation. It's very important what the conversion markets are doing and what the enrichment markets are. And all of that together, kind of holistically, then ties back to your question on like how this stuff is actually being procured and where different pockets of supply are coming from. And it's not as simple as XYZ mine is making this, putting it in the spot market, and then there's a buyer meeting. I think honestly, going through the dynamics of everything, like, you know, forward selling, carry trades that are naked, carry trades that are covered, is probably like a little complex to go through here. But mm-hmm. what I would say is that generally speaking, the carry trade is becoming less impactful in this market. When there was excess supply, significant excess supply, traders or intermediaries in the market could receive spot, sell it forward to a utility, essentially hold the material, right? Promise to deliver it on intervals that were usually escalated at about the interest rate curve and make a nice little spread doing it. First of all, they bought the material at a discount versus the market. They mm-hmm. get to sell it forward and either they carry it or in some cases they would sell that too and take the money and then try and buy it lower in the market. But eventually they just delivered it to their utility counterparty. And the impact of that, sorry, is that those carries were done on a less than 5-year tenor. Oftentimes it was 2 or 3 years. And as you know, and as many listeners probably know, like for a big mine decision to be made, like whether MacArthur River would come back to Kampco, 2 or 3 years of supply contract certainty was never enough, right, to de-risk those larger capital decisions for a company like him, or honestly, even a company like Kazatomprom, or whether or not Paladin would bring back Langer Heinrich, et cetera. So this was very much a market that was fit for the trading community. It served a very good purpose. I mean, it was to the benefit of utilities, right? They were probably getting lower prices with some sort of certainty. Yeah, 1, 2, 3 years out, mostly, yep. Still some delivery certainty. As the spot market, tightened up though, and you didn't have these excess pounds that could be sold at a discount, carried forward. Frankly, as the interest rate markets got more volatile, this source of delivery for utilities is kind of gone. So it's a little less relevant. I do think that at the end of 2021, you still saw, and when you're talking about that commentary that we penned, you still saw some market dynamics to where you would see material come back to the market if we moved too fast.
Yeah.
Which was in our mind, this again, when we wrote that, the consensus was that we were kind of going to $100 plus in the spot market relatively quickly. We mm-hmm. thought there would be all these speed dampeners in the form of these technicalities in the market that would stop that. A lot of that has been washed out though now over the next year. So I think it is a cleaner market for a rise should you see spot market demand, I guess is the long and the short of it. Hard to say exactly what it'll look like because we're very tied into the market. We daily, certainly multiple times a week, are testing to see, get our best estimate of what the structures in the market look like. But our best guess right now is that it's pretty clean. And that, any real demand coming should have a sustained move higher.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think, one of the things that's interesting is so on that note of supply, one of the points that provides a case for investing in uranium is that supply sort of disappeared and prices went low and therefore supply disappeared. And sort of the inverse of that is when prices go up, supply starts to come back. So, how high, can uranium go before supply comes back and before you start to see boost your CapEx, et cetera?
Well, one thing that I think tourists in the market, who must not be modeling, honestly, like supply, fall back on is this idea that that care and maintenance assets and or Kazakh nameplate capacity ramp is a cure-all for this delayed CapEx cycle. Like essentially, like you solve the deficits, right? Like, don't you have idle capacity that comes back on that kind of blows the thesis out? And the answer to that, like, is just no. I mean, it's been rehashed by so many different people now at this point. It's not worth going through, but like ramp up all of that, ramp up all of Kampco supply, all of the Kazakhs nameplate capacity, bring back, any licensed brownfield honestly, bring back development assets, big ones, and you still have a constrained market, at least in the way that we look at this. So one, before anybody talks about it, like that's taken care of. It should be in the model. Mm-hmm. But the second more practical thing that I think we're seeing a lot of now, which is more interesting, it doesn't just apply to uranium, but I'd say it's more difficult in the term of uranium, is that supply is actually technically difficult to bring up. You know, Cameco obviously brought back McArthur River, but you saw them slide down cigar production so that mm-hmm. they could ramp McArthur. Company narrative, and certainly some, this is true to some extent, is that they were still being prudent about placing material in the right hands. But make no mistake, some of that are just the growing pains of challenged supply chains, challenged workforce, et cetera. And if you didn't believe it when Cameco said it, you know, CAP, Kazatomprom, just gave their operational update, their mid-quarter operational update, and a huge production miss.
Yep.
You know, so again, like if you go back a year or two ago, especially mining generalists, just kind of lazily were like, well, you know, Kazatomprom can essentially ramp as much material as they want. They have an endless amount of material that happens. Actually, they haven't even ramped back to their full subsoil use supply capacity, and they're having trouble doing it because they've got sulfuric acid shortages, because they have pipe shortages, because there are yep. labor problems like there are globally. And again, this is not a uranium specific issue, but uranium mining in many cases is more complex. In many cases, it is competing. The labor force is competing with bigger and mm-hmm. frankly, more impactful industries like oil and gas, like to a country's economy. And that means that we should all be very cautious in what we put into rampability, like over the coming years, because we're going to miss, like we've always missed. We're going to miss here. It's not easy. And the two best producers, Cameco and Kazatomprom, have just given you the proof in the pudding that it's going to be challenged, and that we can't snap our fingers.
Yep. The Kazatomprom production miss was sort of going to be my next question. And I was going to ask you if you had sort of any insights or any views on that. And, you know, we've sort of heard about these disruptions since when COVID sort of started. And, do you have anything to say, or do you have any insights specifically to that? I know you mentioned that's not a nuclear specific issue, but it's just, you know, something that you would, or that you would expect more and more.
You know, I don't think we obviously know the company well, and we know the industry well. I don't think I know anything that other people don't know necessarily, but piecing the dots together, it doesn't seem like the market was focused enough, right, on some announcements that Kazatomprom had made. The company had indicated that they want to build their own domestic sulfuric acid plant. Doesn't seem like anybody pieced together why, you know, a uranium miner that has had ample access to sulfuric acid historically wants to spend a few hundred million bucks building their own plant. It was a sign that that part of the market was tight. It was getting tight at the same time as their domestic oil and gas industry was ramping, meaning that the writing was on the wall, right? That sulfuric acid was a problem. We actually have written about that. Piping problems, pipe shortages for ISR globally has been flagged in a lot of instances. Yeah. But again, like the uranium market is not the most sophisticated. Like, I don't think you have a lot of mining dedicated guys that are really deeply looking at this. The read through should have been pretty clear. And so I'm not banging the drum saying, like, you know, that it was that we had. Well, actually, we did. We called this. We did. We thought that they would miss. We thought ramp would be difficult. And I think it is probably going to be challenged in 2024 as well. Until the best case of getting their domestic sulfuric acid plant up in, or sorry, they have domestic, but Kazatomprom's own sulfuric acid plant up in 2025.
Gotcha. Got it. And so, on that note of sort of the Kazakhs, you know, what is sort of the ability, and I guess this is a more broader question, but what's sort of the ability of the West to sort of replace Russian sourced uranium, or to replace Kazakh sourced uranium overall? Because, you know, one thing that we saw, you know, for example, after Russia invaded the Ukraine, you know, we had Europe experienced a large deficit in energy consumption, you know, partly self-imposed through sanctions, etc., but also partly because Russia, in that being sanctioned, you know, has no incentive to supply them. And so, you know, what is the ability of the West to sort of replace that?
Well, let's take one at a time. And sorry, I think I might turn the light on here. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it looks dark to you, but it just got dark all of a sudden. So yeah, I think it's okay. Sorry, let's get it light in here. Apologies, everybody, for the load here. I think I should be able to do this.
With or without light, you know, you look, it's looking great. So don't worry about it.
Very kind of, there we go. I think that'll be a little better. Let's get this set up too. Yeah, so Russian sourced uranium, I mean, U-308 is not a huge part of the market. Let's say like maybe 6% or so, give or take. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it on a conversion and enrichment basis, that's where it starts getting very impactful. You know, 35 to 45% of the global market, depending on how you're calculating it, whether you're talking about conversion or enrichment, is a big, big deal. If you had, you know, a direct Western sanction on Rosatom, like, hey, no more, it would have some significant shockwaves, you know, for the market. The global utility lobby has been very against this, given how big a piece of the pie Rosatom is.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm not going to put a probability on it, but we've always been cautious, you know, in trading that probability or that risk that you have a overnight sanction announcement. You know, I think that could end up being a double-edged sword in some ways.
Yep.
But what we do feel pretty strongly about is that the headline moves to creating a domestic fuel supply or a Western fuel supply is real. And that's mm-hmm. just not, you know, like the 1,000-foot view. I mean, I think you're seeing it, you know, the committees that we're on, the political engagement, like there is a real and concerted bipartisan effort to bring domestic uranium mining through to enrichment here so that we don't have exposure on a go-forward basis. And I think that even on, if you just look at this on a go-forward basis, it means the enrichment market is going to be constrained.
Mm-hmm.
The conversion market is going to be constrained. In theory, the uranium market becomes even more constrained, right? Like Russia's, you know, Russian uranium being excluded on a go-forward basis was never in like the was never in the bingo in the bingo draw.
Yeah.
So that's just another. I mean, even if it is 6% or 8%, I mean, that's 6 or 8% that's not going to the West in the market that's already tight. So in short, they all matter. The right tail risk to pricing, the bananas move, is if you do have some more concrete sanction type action put on Rosatom. And in fact, it didn't seem to be noticed or picked up that much. I mean, I think my partner Arthur might have sent it out to the internet, but yeah, through Twitter. But you know, I mean, a bill is being proposed to many in the House, and it's pretty strong. Like it went to the Senate last year, and it fizzled. Not surprisingly, again, I don't think we're sitting here saying that a Rosatom sanction is coming, but mm-hmm. but the political will to propose it, I think, is an important read through. I mean, that's I think what people should be focused on.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if we don't sanction Rosatom. The question is, on a go-forward basis, how do we treat the fuel supply? How do Western utilities treat the fuel supply? And there is a big shift over the last 12 months. And that will have an impact on pricing over the next several years.
Got it. And you know, moving on from just the topic of, I guess, general supply, I think one thing that we were talking about when, you know, off the record was this, you know, one, you know, you sort of run a hedge fund, and you know, as part of that, what you've been able to do navigating this uranium cycle is, you know, as much as we understand what the bullish case for uranium is, you know, actually managing long positions, as they use it, you know you have tools available to us to sort of manage through the volatility. You know, one is, you know, option strategies, you have shorting as an option, etc. And you know, you've sort of been able to successfully do that. So, you know, could you share a little bit about how, you know, you think about actually managing and running positions in this kind of uranium market?
Yeah, it's a great question. That's actually not one that has been asked, I think, on any podcast. Yeah, so to be clear, you know, we are a hedge fund structure. You know, I mean, I think we're obviously known to be uranium fuel cycle nuclear bulls. But, you know, that the bullishness is a sliding scale for us. And we do short, we hedge, and we don't only invest in uranium. So there are other ways to mitigate risk, even through our long book, or to bring beta down, even through our long book, you know, which, you know, certainly helped us have a good year last year when, you know, benchmarks were down. But without sounding arrogant, you know, the difference is that still there aren't a lot of dedicated, you know, buy side investors to the space. And when I say dedicated, I don't even mean you have to run like a nuclear focused hedge fund. I mean, you have to be an analyst that spends a significant amount of your time understanding this market. Because make no mistake, it is an onion. You know, you peel back a few layers and you realize you have 50 more. And I would say that, you know, the first layer, the tourist layer, is, oh man, the capex cycle is delayed. Spot's going higher. We need more mines. Let's buy equities. That's like layer one of the onion peel. And then in some respects, you can almost get too deep, you know, down the rabbit hole, because it is a complex commodity. It's a complex fuel cycle. It's a complex, nuclear is a complex industry. But I think what we offer people is, you know, dedication, and honestly, a little bit of tenure. We've been here for a long time. I think we've proven to our due diligence network that we have good intentions. You know, we are investors, but we also kind of believe that nuclear is a solution. We believe that it was overlooked, and we think that it's kind of hitting its stride. We think that there will be dedicated analysts at most funds over the next several years. We just have a head start. And so risk management, portfolio management, stock selection, moving into different verticals under kind of the broader energy bucket that we're allowed to invest in, all mm-hmm. comes down to what I think is a differentiated expertise in this particular, in this niche little industry. And I think that the minute where we feel we don't have a better finger on the pulse, it was probably when we're winding down our risk and either diversifying our mandate or trying to push, you know, heavily into what we think the next best trade is. I shouldn't even say next best trade, next best industry to do a deep dive on. Because we do tell our LPs that we can be long, short, and hedge. It's just that we have a bias to something that we think is misunderstood. And we're given the discretion to risk manage around that for as long as we think the cycle has to play out, as long as we think there's money to be made.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And when it comes to, say, picking short ideas to hedge your longs, et cetera, you know, what are sort of the considerations that go into, or like the investment criteria for doing something like that?
Well, you know, I mean, if we're talking about like hedging, you know, and you mentioned options and I didn't address that, like the options market is also very inefficient here. You know, this market goes from extreme pessimism to extreme euphoria in like about 2 seconds. And not surprisingly, the option market starts to reflect what we think are unrealistic. The vol curve starts to adjust to what we think are unrealistic expectations mm-hmm. on both sides. And so, like, without telling you exactly what we're doing, it has been a great source of alpha generation for us to use the option market and what we think are extreme mispricings to our advantage. And we do that in almost any and every way that you could think of for our book. I'll kind of leave it at that. But we do look at that market a lot. You know, we know the catalyst calendar well. We are, you know, one thing that we didn't talk about in the uranium market are broad correlations, you know, and factors, and how it's now getting caught up. Actually, I think your old boss, Mike Green, is an expert on this. And I certainly, not putting myself in his, you know, in his echelon of understanding these things, but it's become a bigger part of our process, you know, is running correlation analysis, factor analysis, seeing indices that we're involved in. And given that we have a mandate to essentially be biased long in this sector, when we think things are acting irrationally because some other part of the energy market or commodity market, mining markets are blowing up, we're often the guys that are on the other side, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. And so, could you give an example of how you use stuff like correlations and factors to your advantage? Just simply because, what sort of factors, you know, do nuclear focused companies or nuclear energy companies go into?
They change. I mean, the short answer is they change a lot. So you have to stay on top of it. But what I would say is that it's mostly like when we see factor rotation or correlation that may be hurting our stocks, and that's going to happen a lot. I mean, right? In many cases, we're talking about high beta junior mining as a part of our book. Like, you have to be cognizant of that. As good as the fuel cycle fundamentals might be, there are going to be periods, sometimes even long periods, where you're just suffering the market. What I would say is that our process is trying to identify periods when broad risk, broad factors, broad correlations are affecting our book at an extreme versus what we think is an extreme in understanding whatever might be happening in the fundamental picture for the book. And we don't always get it right, but when you look at our exposure management sliding in a material way, it's when those two things are extremes, you know, fundamental view versus market technical factors, you know, kind of creating a gap. And they don't present themselves day in and day out, but usually mm-hmm. a few times a year, you get a big crack at it. And we do our best to take advantage.
Got it. So it's sort of more so understanding how flows move with regards to, say, rotating from one factor to another. And
yeah, flows again, correlation to the extent that that's a little bit different than flows, and you know, whether or not you might be in a factor basket. Also, to be honest, there's a lot of tourist capital that comes in and out. You see that, frankly, a lot in the options market. We are really fastidious, I guess I would say, about tracking to the best of our ability who is the size open interest and for what reason, you know, in the options market, which can get chunky in a relatively illiquid space. Mm-hmm. Having a handle on that, I think, also gives us comfort on on days or months when the sector is puking aggressively. How much of it is a fundamental view versus a stop out, a liquidation, capitulation, et cetera. And we're not day traders, you know, absolutely not. And there are many positions that we have not touched in 4 or 5 years, but you asked about risk management. And frankly, sleeping at night in a volatile sector and having detailed information on all of these things, not just the fundamentals of the commodity, not just the fundamentals of the equities that we hold, but even the fundamentals and the technicals of the options market, flows, correlations, et cetera, right, gives us a good picture. That is the mosaic through which we are viewing this market. And since it's really all we're doing, we've gotten pretty good at it.
Yeah, no, this is excellent. And one more thing that sort of is somewhat related to this is, you know, overall, you know, uranium is sort of a very broad term. And so once you dig a little bit deeper, you know, you sort of have these different, different aspects of uranium, you know, when you have, say, the utilities on one hand, the producers on the other, and even within producers. So, you know, one thing that came up in one of the conversations we had off the record was stuff like HALEU, which is sort of a very specific form of uranium that has, you know, broad applications and, you know, small modular reactors, etc., and, you know, could potentially be an important form of uranium going forward. And so, you know, keeping that in mind, you know, we're, you know, on a more specific level, you know, how would you sort of bucket or group you know, the various aspects of the uranium market, and, you know, where do you see opportunity on sort of a more specific level without naming individual companies?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that we're really excited about, to be honest, are some of the newer tech and or newer concepts that are rising into like the broader advanced nuclear sphere. We think many of them will be public over the coming years. We've announced a few of them that are going public and, you know, that we're anchoring. But, you know, part of our, you know, firm mandate is shifting into doing privates. And what we're seeing is new fuel designs, new forms of waste storage and disposal, reprocessing, in addition to obviously new reactor designs themselves. And I think like if you're bullish nuclear or you're bullish energy and you think the delta in nuclear is, you know, in nuclear ads is kind of mispriced in the market, it is our firm view that there are some great companies, the next generation companies for the sector that are, you know, too cheap, you know, we think relative to their impact. And again, that really spans everything, I guess, to your question, from new fuel designs to new reactor designs, to better waste disposal, to better services, you know, to services companies who are kind of priced still as if this is a market that's going to decline by 30-40% in the West over the next decade, and now it's a growing market at the same time frame. And all that switched over the last 12 to 18 months, and we don't think private investors have really caught up to that shift in the macro in terms of how they're evaluating these businesses.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah, and we know one more thing in terms of, I guess, newer technologies is, and you sort of discussed this again on, in one of your Segra Capital commentaries, is sort of this prospect or promise or potential of nuclear fusion and, you know, sort of, you know, atomic energy and how that actually plays into, you know, the, into nuclear energy. And so when you think about that, you know, do you have, any views on, you know, sort of when that comes to market on a broad level, you know, are there opportunities there? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I mean, we think there are opportunities. I mean, I think, you know, our focus, if you're talking about the kind of new nuclear fission or fusion, is really on how commercial the companies are, how good the business plan is, frankly, to be a commercial, viable business. There are certainly some investors, venture investors, energy dedicated investors, who you may or may not be able to do a better job of vetting the tech specifically. We are usually looking a little bit later stage where some of the tech is de-risked, but there would still be a very, very wide spread in business model, like what different companies are actually trying to achieve. And we, as a firm, would always be kind of trending towards finding the more commercially end-user focused advanced company, whether it be fission, fusion, or any services, fuels, et cetera. So tying that back to your fusion question, look, we think it makes sense to invest in fusion. We think there is a wide landscape now. The fusion, you know, market was robust over, has been robust over the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. It is, in a way that fission is not, it has been embraced, you know, by the clean tech markets, by energy investors broadly, by energy transition, impact. Fission is still a little bit on the, you know, kind of on the fringe there, which we frankly like. But we have made a large fusion investment in General Fusion. Again, it's really their timeline to being commercial that hooked us, in addition to what we think is a significant valuation discount to their direct peers in the market, because they're a little bit, they're actually a Canadian company. So being out of Silicon Valley has given them, I think, a little or a large discount. But I say all that, not being able to put a timeline on this. You know, I mean, in terms of the company we're invested in terms of the comps, you know, if we can get a working prototype in the early 2030s, that is a wonderful achievement for mankind. Mm-hmm. One, that is past the timeline on when the strongest bite in the fuel cycle is in terms of supply-demand mismatch. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, given that, you know, we really are believers in broad nuclear over not just the next 5 years, but decades, we really don't believe anybody in the future is going to be shutting down quality working fission that still has time on their license to replace it with anything, fusion or otherwise. So, you know, again, like these are 60 to 100 year assets now, by and large. Our view is that they run, you know, barring a maintenance or operational issue, they're going to be running through their licenses. And what we bolt on in terms of new technology, whether it's fusion or anything else, is just going to be additive. We need a lot, right? When you look at the different scenarios laid out by every credible academic institution trying to model this, we just need a lot of everything. And, you know, we've certainly said it 1,000 times. I think it's becoming closer to consensus. Like wind and solar, even with batteries that we don't have, cannot bridge this gap. It is time that the energy markets start looking towards things that can really start to solve it under the timelines under which we're trying to solve it. Even just
2050, yeah.
Yeah, even just to be academically genuine, you know, because like it's honestly been farcical how we've chosen to kind of ignore facts or cherry pick facts to fit narratives. And what's nice about the energy market, or like, I guess the volatility in energy markets, is that I think whether you're pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear or somewhere in between, the conversation is just getting much more honest. And that's all you can hope for. And I think that's where we're at now.
Yep. No, awesome. 100%. Adam, one, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And before I let you go, you know, do you have any closing thoughts or anything you want to share with our audience that we haven't discussed just yet?
You know, I think we've covered a lot. I mean, I was
trying to focus on, I guess, the lesser known concepts or the lesser known ideas within the uranium world. Hopefully, you know, I've done a decent job at that.
I think you've done a great job. I mean, the only thing I'd say to the audience is that I'm very impressed, you know, with you. I mean, a young person, you know, dedicating so much time to learning, to being engaged with the market. You know, that's a great thing. I wish I'd been as proactive, like I said, when I was your age. And I've no doubt that if you keep at it, you'll have a lot of success. And the second thing is just, you know, we talk a lot about nuclear, you know, Segra Capital does, but really we're generalist investors by background. You know, I mean, our goal is to be doing this for a very long time, yeah. But to be staying fresh with all ideas. And I say that not because I care if we're pigeonholed as nuclear guys, but I say that because I think some people might think that like we're forced to be bullish, mm-hmm. like, you know, that this is like our horse and we're going to ride it to the end. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, we still wholeheartedly believe that this is a sector where you can make a lot of money, that we're in the early stages of the cycle. And the minute that we don't think that, our business will pivot. So I guess maybe that would be my closing words. You know, if anyone's skeptical that this is just, you know, long-term uranium bulls getting long in the tooth, I can tell you it's not.
Awesome. Adam, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was great having you on. You can find Adam at Segra Capital, at Segra Capital. On Twitter, and you can go on his website, segracapital.com, and read some of his commentaries, which is super interesting. They're sort of deep dives into lesser known aspects of the uranium world, and so I think it's terrific. And once again, Adam, thank you for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a good time.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.